Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
I can't remember exactly, but I think it was here that I first propped.
What did you do here?
I think this is where I started shooting.
And were you standing or...
Kneeling.
Kneeling. And which direction were you shooting?
In that direction.
And what were you shooting at?
The passing cars.
You left that area there. Where did you go then?
To the edge of the bushes here.
Anywhere?
Propped there.
Whereabouts?
Kneeling. At the edge of the where the bushes start here.
Yeah. And what did you do there?
Continued firing.
What was your intent when you were shooting at those cars?
Shoot at the people in them.
And what was your intent towards those people?
Kill them. Right. The first one fell onto the road and then the second one, I don't know where he came from, but I dropped him as well. I fired at, I think, two cars that went past and then the motorcyclist.
Right. Well, you told me before that you had a desire to be shot.
Yeah, I still had ammo though.
So what are you saying, you weren't prepared to be shot when you ran out of ammunition?
Oh, well, I wanted to keep on going until I ran out of ammo.
That's the voice of 19-year-old Julian Knight. The year was 1987, and he was reenacting his Hoddle Street shooting spree for police. He killed seven people during his 40-minute rampage on one of Melbourne's busiest roads. He injured 19, and he very nearly brought down a police helicopter. 30 years later, Knight still looms large in the Australian psyche. He should have been eligible for parole in 2014, but the court system and the community agree he should stay just where he is. It encourages his belief that he is somehow the real victim in all of this.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
I hate to name drop, but no less an expert than Chopper Reed once told me that the only man he feared was Julian Knight. Because that prick's mad, were his exact words. Now, as much as I trust Chopper's judgment on these issues, the fact that our guest today disagrees with that assessment is interesting because he is one of this country's most respected criminal psychologists. Tim Watson Munro has developed deep therapeutic relationships with some of Australia's scariest men, and probably unsurprisingly, ended up resorting to some pretty dramatic coping mechanisms when things started to get on top of him. Tim's book, Dancing with Demons, details his work with people like Julian Knight, Alphonse Gangitano, and Alan Bond, but it's also a very honest account of his humiliating drug-fueled fall from grace. It's a ripping read. Emily and I spoke to Tim recently, and we began by asking about the beginning of his brilliant career.
Well, I've spent all this time assessing prisoners. I started my career in 1978. I was the resident psychologist at Parramatta Jail for a period of about 3 years, and that was a more general role. I was sort of intricately involved in the management of the jail, dealing with prisoners' needs and their problems and so on. I was 25 when I went into that job, and pretty green, and it was a rapid learning curve for me. During that period, I set up a number of programs that were considered quite revolutionary for the time. The first drug rehab program in any jail in Australia, and more specifically, a program where juvenile offenders spent a day in prison. It was an experiential learning for them as a crime deterrent scheme, and it was very successful. It kept about 60% of these kids from going back to court, let alone prison. Out of that, I was asked to give a paper in Melbourne. I met a top forensic psychiatrist, and he suggested that I go and work with him. So a forensic psychologist, really, I mean, they have many roles. They can work in jails. They can work with the police with profiling or training police in communication, hostage negotiation. In my case, most of the work I've done has been the assessment of offenders and preparing reports for barristers who use them in court cases.
What can you tell us about some of your really high-profile cases? I'm reading Alan Bond, the Hoddle Street gunman, yeah. Julian Knight.
That'll be 30 years in a couple of weeks.
Since Hoddle Street?
I think so, yeah.
Yep. Alphonse Gangitano, very famous in Melbourne as the gangster whose death sort of kicked off the Melbourne gang wars.
Well, it's an interesting one. Of the 20-something people who were murdered during the gangland wars, 17 of mine had been clients at some point or other.
Wow.
And when the word got around as to who was possibly responsible, I put out a call and I said, can you ask him to stop because he's killing my cash flow.
killing my clients. Wow.
Yeah, he was killing all my clients. Yeah. And I was heavily involved for a long time, I guess, back then, dealing with people like Alphonse, Jason Moran, Graham Kinnaburra, the Munster as he was known, and a range of others. Alan Bond was a client of mine for about 4 years. And Julian Knight, it is 30 years in August, the Hoddle Street massacre occurred. And I still have contact with Julian. He rings me from time to time. And if I'm out that way at Port Phillip Jail, I pop in and have a chat with him.
Now, Tim, when I read that section in the book about Julian Knight, you were profoundly affected by the crimes that happened, but also your dealings with Julian, weren't you? Can you talk us through a bit about that? Because I think that is a crime that Melburnians who are old enough to remember it, you'll never forget.
Well, it was the biggest mass murder in Australian history at the time. I mean, Port Arthur, I guess, took that title away from Julian. But it was a very big deal in Melbourne, and I think it changed the psychology of the city irrevocably. We went from a place where we felt it was safe to be on the streets to a place where people became increasingly anxious and worried about their safety. I was quite young then. I was 34 when he was referred to me for an assessment. And I spent about a year with him on and off. And during that time, I didn't see it at the time. It really did affect me. I was exposed to all the forensic material, the photographs, the victim statements, those who survived, or those people who had witnessed what had occurred. But it wasn't until probably a decade later, after I'd gone through a very severe depressive illness, I developed a problem with cocaine, which went on for a few years, intensely so for about 12 months. And I went into treatment myself that I realised that probably the crossroads for me was that particular case in the way that it affected me.
Do you think you developed PTSD from the details of that case?
I think I do have PTSD referral to that case, less so these days. But, you know, for a long time I'd have flashbacks. It made me very depressed, anxious for other people. I mean, it's interesting since that time, I mean, we see this so much happening around the globe now. It's almost not front page news, but back then it was. It was a very big case.
Well, still in Australia, by Australian standards, it's an extraordinary case. On the evening of Sunday, the 9th of August 1987, Julian Knight sort of secreted himself, didn't he, behind bushes on Hoddle Street, which is a main street in Melbourne, close to the city, in Clifton Hill there, and he started shooting people who were driving past, and he killed 7 and injured 19, but psychologically injured the entire city.
Mm. I was a young girl and my dad worked in the city, and I remember thinking, I wonder if Dad was on Hoddle Street. Mm. Like, you know, I was probably about 10 maybe then. Yeah, so I remember it well.
Yeah, I think we all remember it, those of us who were around. And it was probably about 6 kilometres from where I lived at the time. Mm. And I couldn't believe it. I thought this is really a step up in criminal behaviour. And then, of course, probably within 10 days he was referred to me. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know whether I was going to be confronted by a raging psychopath who was full of anger. Yeah. But, in fact, he was 19 years of age. He was in the old Pentridge Jail hospital in his pyjamas. And I found him to be, extraordinarily cooperative, polite, almost obsequious in terms of the way that he was dealing with me. But he'd come from a military background. His father was a captain in the army, and he'd wanted to be a soldier all his life, and eventually got into Duntroon. The family had cautioned him to not take the job. They felt that he lacked the maturity and that he should wait a year or so, but he was so determined to become an officer and a gentleman, I guess, that he went to Duntroon, and it all sort of collapsed within 8 months.
His father's at Dunfern in January 87, and of course Hoddle Street, as you correctly point out, was in August of that year.
And he was quite an intelligent, oh, he is, he's not dead, an intelligent young man, wasn't he? Or isn't he?
Julian's highly intelligent, and his IQ is probably in the top 2% of the population. But he has frequently expressed frustration over the years that since he's been in jail, he hasn't been able to really utilise his intelligence. The best job he's had has been sorting nuts and bolts when he gets a job. He wanted to work in the library. He's tried to do university degrees from time to time, but he can't access the sort of computers and materials that are required these days to do tertiary study.
Why not? Does he do things he shouldn't do on the computer? Or I don't know how it works in jail, but...
Well, look, there's been a lot of stories about Julian Mart, but the issue, I think, is other prisoners are able to do university courses. They get access to computers and so on. And the problem with him, and I certainly... what he did was horrible. It was the worst crime, and he deserved to be severely punished for it. He was given a life sentence of 27 years. And normally in the course of that time, people would spend a third of their time in maximum security, a third of their time in medium security, and then a third of their time in minimum security. He spent the whole 30 years in maximum security. So he's there to be punished. And in the last year or so, they've passed an Act of Parliament that says that really he can't be released until he's either dying or he's so old that he doesn't present a potential threat to the community.
I think that's the issue for most of us, is that we're still very afraid of Julian.
Look, I think we're very afraid of uncertainty per se, and we've got good reason to be so. The world's changed dramatically in the last 30 years. We're seeing terrorism occur, if not on a daily basis, a weekly basis globally. And if he had done this crime now, I mean, he would clearly be labelled a terrorist. Mm-hmm. So we're very unsure about anyone who presents potential danger, and in fact, people who don't present danger as far as we know. And because of that, we're highly cautious in how we deal with them.
In your professional opinion, should Julian Knight ever be released?
In my professional opinion, I think greater steps should be taken to optimise the possibility of him succeeding in the community should he ever be released. Should he be released now? Probably not, because there's been nothing done for him in terms of rehabilitation over the last 30 years. So you think about how Melbourne's changed, let alone the world, over 3 decades. It'd be like opening a spaceship for him and leaving him on Mars. He needs to be trained. He needs to have rehabilitation and treatment. None of this has occurred. So until that occurs, it's highly unlikely to even look at letting him out. He needs to have a kind of program that would go over the next 5 to 6 years at least, I think, before you could address that issue properly.
I'm fascinated that you were so deeply affected by Julian's crimes that you experienced PTSD as a result of knowing him and seeing the material, crime scene photos and stuff, but you still visit with him. Why? Do you have some kind of affection for him or...?
I think it's not unusual for people who work in my area, policemen too, ambulance drivers, even firemen. We all get aspects of vicarious trauma, as it's described. And I've worked through those issues pretty much. And it's more about what he did that affected me than the person, if you can understand the distinction. And it's 30 years on. He's grown up a fair bit over 30 years. And I don't visit him every week. It's if I'm out there and he wants to see me, I'll have a chat with him about what's going on. I'm probably one of the few people that would interact with him on that basis. He has no real friends anywhere, so it doesn't affect me talking to him.
And I guess that you would be someone who, that aspect of him having someone to talk to could help him with any rehabilitation, but you'd know him in a way that no one else would, I guess, so that's why you can do those visits.
Well, I think that's fair comment without blowing my own trumpet, but I met him when he was 19. He's nearly 50 now. And there have been long periods where I've not had contact with him. But certainly, the last year or two, that contact has resumed. And look, I'm happy to see him. I don't charge him a bill for it. It's something that I think should be done. You can't just leave somebody to rot in jail, in my view.
I am really part of the book. The book is fantastic. But, you know, your early years when you started, you working in Parramatta, which, as you described, that was a very rough jail, wasn't it? Was that the jail that you said was like the last resort?
When I went to Parramatta Jail, I was 25. I looked 18. I'd come from a fairly kind of privileged background that I detail in the book. So for me, it was another planet. But I enjoyed being there, and it was a jail of last resort where end-of-the-road prisoners were sent, prisoners who were considered to have no prospects at all, who were typically doing an average sentence of 12 to 15 years. And that's why, paradoxically, it presented itself as a jail where you could actually set up programs in the knowledge that those individuals who became involved with the program weren't going anywhere else. Other jails, people these days might go for a day or two or a month or two and they'll get moved. But Parramatta, it was like a little village, if you know what I mean. It was people got to know each other and they had to get on with each other. And I would select prisoners who were talented to assist in the running of these programs. But I was never really frightened. I found the jail intimidating in a way and the subculture intimidating, but I never really had any problems on a one-to-one basis with the prisoners that I dealt with. Yeah, I think we were trailblazers. I think that a lot of these programs, and not just my programs, other programs that eventually became established in other jails, created opportunities for more psychologists to work in prisons. So when I worked with the New South Wales Department of Corrective Services, I think there was probably about 20 psychologists statewide. It's an empire now. Of course, there's a lot more prisoners in jail, but they have much greater kind of sway in what goes on. There's much more accountability, and there's a lot more in terms of giving treatment and providing rehabilitation programs for prisoners to prepare them to be released to the community. So it's certainly changed a great deal over, you know, nearly 40 years for me, and it was a great privilege to be part of that. And when I started, not many people worked in jails at all, and forensic psychology wasn't really even recognised as a specialty area. It is now, and people do PhDs and doctorates of psychology, professional doctorates, in order to work in those sorts of environments.
I guess we, as a culture, we probably ebb and flow in our interest in prison rehabilitation. Would that be fair to say that we go through patches where we want it all to be about all punishment, and then we go through patches where we want it to be all about rehabilitation?
Look, I think that's right. There's never been votes in rehabilitation in prisons. And so anything you try to get through in a prison environment is notoriously difficult. When I worked at Parramatta, there'd been a Nagel Royal Commission into prisons. There'd been some riots at Bathurst Jail, and the Royal Commission said that prisons had to be more transparent and had to be more focused on rehabilitation and training and treatment. And they appointed the late Professor Tony Vinson, who was a professor of sociology, to become the chairman of the Corrective Service Commission. So I was very lucky because the whole focus was on rehabilitation. There were then problems associated with the running of jails in New South Wales. There was a riot. Public opinion changed. And consequently, there was a reaction against all of that and went backwards for a while. So you're quite right, there is an ebb and flow. But I think there's a sort of constancy to it now that psychology and forensic psychology is well entrenched in prison environments. And the benefits of having psychologists working in jails and assisting with decision-making on treatment, rehabilitation and parole even is a great service to the community. We want to know who we're dealing with. We need to do risk analysis of the people we're going to let out and so on.
Well, you were certainly at the forefront of that. You were chairman of the Forensic College of the Australian Psychological Society. I can't even say it, but you were it. And you were also on the advisory board of the Department of Criminology at Melbourne University. But take us to a nice, jazzy Melbourne restaurant on a Friday afternoon in 1997 when a mate of yours says, "Here, have you tried this? Have you tried cocaine? And we'll be back to hear about Tim's dizzying downfall after this. Tim Watson Munro was at the top of his game in 1997. He was Australia's leading criminal and forensic psychologist, and he was assessing and counselling the most dangerous members of our community. Then, during one of the regular boozy lunches he enjoyed with friends and peers, a well-meaning friend introduced him to cocaine, and it changed everything.
Well, they were great lunches, and it's...
they sound great.
Yeah, they do.
When I talked about vicarious trauma, I think criminal lawyers too suffer a degree of vicarious trauma. It's just the nature of the work we do.
Yeah.
It's not at the Land Titles Office. You're dealing with really horrific crimes a lot of the time. You're dealing with horrific family circumstances and histories. And there's a lot of stress in going to court, giving evidence, preparing a case if you're a lawyer and so on. And arising from that, a sort of lunch group evolved with top lawyers, myself, others, artists, poets, writers and so on. And we used to go to lunch generally the last Friday of each month at a hotel.
How many hours did it go for, Tim? Yeah.
Well, I was always getting into trouble when I went home. You know, start of midday and you get home at about 10 p.m.
Yeah.
So it was that sort of thing. But, you know, and initially it was fun, but then it became kind of less than fun. You know, we used to drink a lot of these lunches and it was a way of unwinding. I used to see this with the police that I trained, that they used to all go to the old police club in Mackenzie Street in Melbourne, and they would drink on a Friday for 10 or 11 hours simply to debrief on the work they was doing. With these lunches, we'd do that. We'd have entertainment. We'd laugh. And at some point in that kind of process, cocaine was introduced, and some people started using coke. I was one of those people, stupidly. I deeply regret it still. And it kind of went from there.
And where did it go? I mean, that is the story of cocaine, though, isn't it? It is famously a drug that starts off really fun, and you think to yourself, God, where has this been all my life? But then it kind of ends up making you really edgy and crazy and angry and, you know, how did it go for you?
You know a bit about it.
I know a little bit about it, yeah.
That's what happens. I mean, it's a very seductive drug. And, you know, back then it was something that energised me. It's something that sort of blocked the emotions from my thoughts. There was a lot else going on in my life at that time. And, you know, it seemed like fun. But, you know, with the affliction of time, it just seems to it changes your neurochemistry. And I talk a lot about this in the book in one of the chapters. I think it's called Dopamine Cowboys. About how, you know, people have all sorts of things that change their brain chemistry, whether it's gambling, whether it's pornography, whether it's drugs, whether it's alcohol. And with me, it just, you know, I lost my perspective in a major way. The danger about all that is you don't see it. You know, I was clearly a train wreck or heading towards the cliff, but I thought life was fine. I couldn't understand what all the fuss was about until it happened. And then I realised it had a big impact on me.
You were spending about $2,000 a week on your addiction at one stage.
Well, at my peak, that's right. I mean, that didn't go on for the whole time. But in the background, my first wife that I'd separated from, I was divorced, I'd remarried. She was 40. We had two adolescent children. And she went to the doctor one day with a stomach ache, and she was diagnosed with inoperable terminal bowel cancer.
Oh.
And, you know, that was, for me, the final straw. I was working hard. I loved Sue, even though we were divorced. We'd known each other from university days. We loved our children. I had a second wife, and we had two other children. And Carla, my second wife, was pregnant. So there was a lot on my plate. You know, that's why it all happened. I lost my way and I lost my judgment.
And, in fact, there was a raid just, 3 weeks after your first wife, Sue, died. That sort of put you in a very precarious situation in terms of your drug use?
Well, I wasn't the victim of that raid.
No.
Andrew Fraser, who was a criminal lawyer, was raided by the police. And he'd been somebody I'd used cocaine with. I suspected I'd be on the police intercepts. And I was actually the party at the time with a number of, I think I described them as the glitterati of the legal profession in Melbourne. It was another mate's birthday party, a prominent QC. And when I heard about this, I was given all sorts of advice from the lawyers there, but I just thought, this is really the crossroads moment for me. I need to really come clean with it all if I'm going to get on with my life. I knew by doing that that, you know, clearly my career could well come to an end, and it did for a while, but I felt it was the time to really just get away from drugs and get away from those people, and that's what I did.
Gosh, lucky break in a way for you.
I think it probably saved my life. You know, you read about, and I've certainly had a few clients over the years who just dropped dead from heart attacks. And, you know, when the autopsies are done, they find traces of coke in their system. It can affect your cardiac rhythms quite dramatically with some people, and they get cardiac arrhythmia and they just drop dead. You've probably read about it yourself, you know. The old 20-year-old who's used his first line of coke and he's dropped dead in the toilets.
So you ended up with a good behaviour bond and a $1,000 fine as well. That seems like a pretty sort of, it doesn't sound like the harshest kind of bottoming out that I've ever heard of.
No, and it was a good behaviour bond without conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And probably wasn't so harsh because the magistrate said my integrity was beyond reproach. I mean, I'd done a lot of work in Melbourne for many years, 20 years just about when all this happened.
Mm.
I'd done a lot of pro bono work. I was well regarded by the profession. I was well regarded by the judiciary.
It must have been shocking for them, for the other people in the profession and in this sort of wider legal community, that this incredible psychologist of all things has been dabbling in this mind-blowing drug to the extent that you've sort of lost control of your life a bit.
And some of them might have been quietly a bit like, ooh, if this could happen to Tim, it could happen to me.
Yeah.
It's a good point. A lot of people were shocked because they said it was never reflected in the quality of the work I did.
Mm.
One guy rang me and said, now I understand why you always had a head cold. I was always sleeping in the
cold. Yeah.
But, you know, it really... Phil Dunn, who was a QC, he said when the news of this got around, it was like a bushfire sweeping in from the western plains of Melbourne.
Oh, I bet.
People were understandably shocked by it, and I understand they felt very let down by it as well. It's 18 years ago, and life has moved on.
Yeah.
But it was quite a sort of seismic event in my life and the lives of others when it happened.
How did it change, do you think, the perception of the criminal set? I wonder if it sort of gave people that you work with in prisons more respect for you, knowing that you sort of weren't perfect. Would that be the case?
Look, I think as the years have gone by, that's certainly the case. I think initially a lot of the crooks may have felt a bit let down by it. But, I mean, this was all pre-Google, and now Google's everywhere, and most people that are referred to me Google me, as you do.
Yep.
And a lot of them say, I'm very comfortable in talking to you because you're not just a guy who knows a lot about it from an academic point of view or a professional point of view, but you've actually, you know, you've walked the walk.
Yeah.
And I know a lot about recovery. That's the point. I know how you can get through this.
That's the thing. You've walked the walk all the way back. So you're in a position where you can talk with some knowledge about knowing how steep that climb looks from the bottom.
Mm.
I think that's a fair comment, and I know about addiction, I know about how it changes your thinking, and I know what it takes to get through an addiction and then remain sober or clean. I mean, it's interesting, the international benchmark for full remission, as it's described, that is that, you know, you're never cured, but you're in full remission. I've been in full remission for, you know, nearly 16 to 18 years, is 2 years. But I think it's actually five. I think it takes about 5 years if you've had a heavy addiction for your neurochemistry to reconfigure itself so that you start to look at the world in a kind of less anxious, paranoid and troubled way.
You write a bit in the book about the drug ICE, what that's doing to society. I mean, that's It's a topic that you hear spoken about quite a lot. Everyone, I feel like everyone kind of knows someone who knows someone who's on ice. What do you think that situation poses for society and in terms of actually being able to properly recover from an addiction? Because it just seems like ice fries your brain quicker than booze or cocaine or dope will do.
Well, it does. I mean, it's turbocharged coke, isn't it? And it, although it's a different chemical, it works in the same way. And the real danger with ice is that it has a half-life of days. Cocaine, typically, you know, after 20 minutes, you need another line.
Ice is cheap. Yeah. A lot of people have said to me over the years that, you know, they're glad cocaine's expensive, otherwise they'd be a coke addict. But that's not an inhibitor with ice, is it?
No, it's probably cheaper to buy a point of ice than it is to have five schooners. Mm. But there was an interesting study that was spoken about in the press this week about Australia being the drug capital of the universe. Mm-hmm. And Sydney's the sort of cocaine capital of Australia. They measure effluent and see where there are hot spots of cocaine use. But the major drug, the one that's causing all the big concern, is ice. It's in the suburbs. It's everywhere. Mm. Housewives, school kids, school teachers, you know, the reach of this drug is terrifying, really.
And I remember former surfing champion Tom Carroll, who spoke about his recovery from ice addiction recently. He said that initially for him it started as just a way to help him cope with life, with the sort of low-key suburban life that he's living, getting the kids going, getting to work, getting everything moving along. Is that why it's such a threat to us? Because of, you know, our lifestyle kind of leads us into wanting help.
Well, you know, nobody ever thought they'd become an alcoholic when they had their first sip of wine.
Yeah.
You know, it's not on their radar. Yeah. And the problem with drug use in the community is that it's gaining greater acceptance as not being dangerous, which is really a folly, I think. So people who are bored, people who are tired, people who want a bit of titillation in their life, if somebody offers them some ice, it would seem that they're taking up the offer. Some research suggests that one or two pipes of ice is enough to get an addiction chain going in your brain, and that kind of neurochemical change that I described earlier then takes over and your thinking changes, your judgment changes. A lot of research suggests that it affects the prefrontal cortex of the brain, which is responsible for cognition, personality, impulse control, judgment, consequential thinking, those sorts of things. So people use ice, and I guess for coke too, if you look what happened to me, they lose their judgment. But the problem with ice is people are constantly topping up, and so the amount of dose in the kind of blood system in your body is always increasing. And that's why you hear about people going into these psychotic rages when they've been sleep deprived for 5 days at a time, and they're just pumped and paranoid and anxious and quite often hearing things or seeing things. They become quite dangerous. And it's filtering down onto the street through random acts of violence. Mm. I mean, we read about this a lot too, where people get stabbed and they're total strangers are being murdered in the streets by individuals who are clearly affected by ice. And I've seen a lot of these people, you know, you see them in the prison cells a day or two after it's happened, and often they don't know why it happened. They don't understand it. They don't remember it. They just remember being very frightened and out of touch with reality.
Oh, God.
We're all vulnerable to addiction. Mm. It just depends what your particular poison is. Mm. The problem about ice is that it's ubiquitous, and people can score ice, you know, 3 phone calls and they've got some ice at their doorstep. And it changes people. I don't think that they're going to end up like the people they read about in the newspapers, but inevitably they do. And I've seen it through all strata of society, you know, business executives, professional people, housewives, school kids. Mm. It seems to take hold of them in a way that no other drug has, from my experience, over 40 years.
Your story also reminds me how important it is to talk to our kids about coping mechanisms so that, you know, we can recognise when we are reaching out for an inappropriate coping mechanism. I need to recognise that in myself. I'm 44 and I know that if I start looking for wine every day, that's not just a mum meme. That's actually me not coping and reaching out for an inappropriate coping mechanism.
Like, I don't drink and I haven't done for a lot of years, but I will still look for maybe food sometimes.
Something, yes.
Or just get, and it's always on my mind about that stuff.
I think it's a good point. I mean, I cope with stress now through exercise, talking to people. I have the occasional kind of meltdown in my head, you know, because of the stress that I'm under at times, but I don't reach for the bottle and I don't reach for illicit drugs. I've learned through, you know, bitter experience and maturity, therapy, that you need to talk to people about things when you feel that you're losing your way a bit and to get back on track. And I think you're right. Once you start thinking about the bottle or whatever it is, and then, you know, it's not a short period of time, or it is a short period of time, I should say, before you start drinking again or doing whatever you do. And that's the sort of path to relapse, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Tim's book is called Dancing with Demons, and it's out now. You can also buy Emily's books on our Facebook page. That's Australian True Crime on Facebook. Thank you for downloading this episode, and thank you so much for your ongoing support of this podcast.